Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And as of this recording, the robot singularity has probably not occurred.
As far as we know.
As far as we know.
But we're not really sure how to define that, right?
Right. It's kind of an evasive term. I mean, roughly, we're talking about computers, robots, reaching the level where they not only meet us on the same mental plane, but they exceed us, and they become greater than us. And they, and then in various scenarios, could conceivably play out. People really like to have fun with the darker images.
They just leave us in the dust, like literally.
Yeah, like they take over the world, or they just decide to destroy all humans, or our lives become so robotic and so enhanced by robotics that the human part of our life becomes kind of a core to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, but not a necessity of it.
Well, I think I love talking about the singularity because it does, it brings up so many different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about it plenty and always feel like you have like this very, positive outlook on the singularity, whereas sometimes I get paranoid and I think, oh no.
Oh yeah.
To be taken over.
And like those days when you don't even come into work and we have to call and see where you are because it's the singularity and anxiety is getting taking over.
Yes. Yeah. Those are the days when I've locked myself in my bunker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I tend to look at it like, you know, if the coffee machines become as smart as humans, then we're just going to have really great coffee. I mean, that's.
See?
Yeah.
I love that. That's the sort of positive pluck that I'm talking about here. But in that context, you know, it seems like, okay, this is something that could be far away or it could be something that's really near. We don't know.
Right.
But robots are having a fundamental impact on our lives in myriad ways, right?
Yeah. I remember, I was looking into some information about recruiting into computing programs and they pointed out that there's virtually no field, of study anymore that does not contain programming and computerization.
Right.
And it's going to get to where there's going to be no part of our society that isn't touched by robotics in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Robotics or really high-end programming.
Or us even being touched by robots, right?
Right.
I mean, we've talked about Roxy, the sex bot.
Literally touched by, well, I don't know if the robot's doing, in this situation, the robot's just being touched, I think.
Oh, but I'm sure very soon there will be touching.
Yeah, but it's very hard to argue that it's consensual.
That's true.
Yeah.
And unless it's programmed, I suppose.
Yeah. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah. And we will get to that, definitely. But again, thinking about robots and how they're being used in day-to-day life, we actually turn to Dr. Ronald Arkin. He's the Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing and is the director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
Yeah. It's not a mobile lab, though. It doesn't, you know. It's not like a bus.
It doesn't break away from the rest of the building or anything and
it's never one
go gallivanting around Atlanta. No. But he and his team, along with research engineer Alan Wagner, they've blazed the way when it comes to robotics and in particular thinking about robotic ethics. And they have created a robot or robots that can deceive.
Yeah, and it all boils down to an algorithm, or more specifically, a cognitive deception modeling algorithm, or a series of algorithms.
Yep.
And it involves not only giving the robot the capacity to fool another robot or a human, but giving it the ability to decide when to fool another human. Because that's an important thing. We all have the ability, as humans, we all have the ability to deceive, the ability to lie. And one of the core things we have to decide in life is when to tell the truth and when to lie. And if you're out of balance on that, life can get pretty messy and nobody will want to hang out with you. Either because you never code anything, for consumption. You never, dish out a white lie or two, or you just lie all the time and are kind of a jerk.
Yeah. So, I mean.
So we don't want to create jerk robots.
No.
But the problem is that robots in their simple form are, They're robotic. They're not gonna code anything to make it go down easier.
Yeah. So it is really interesting. Like, how do you do this? What is deception anyway? Even when mm-hmm. when you're talking about a robot, and so we actually talked to Dr. Arkin about this, and this is what he had to say about deception and what it is defined as in robotics.
It's actually a definition we borrowed from cognitive science, which is a false communication that tends to benefit the communicator.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing is that you will benefit by saying something that is untrue. In the press, this has often been referred to as lying robots and the like as well, too. It's a false communication. Is lying leaving a trail in the ground? I don't know. That's a verbal act. One could argue this is more expansive than simply lying in this case. It's basically trying to create a deception to make someone believe something that isn't true and act in a way. The work that we looked at in the military, for the military, was more a fundamental question of what deception is and how it could be employed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not simply writing up lookup tables and saying these are the sets of actions. As I think I mentioned, or if I didn't, there is an entire field manual for the U.S. Army on deception, deceptive techniques, because it's important. It's crucially important and an appropriate way to conduct warfare. But this isn't just saying, do this in this set of circumstances, do this in this set of circumstances. This is, I have to understand you. Speaking as a robot, I have to understand you and learn what your potential outcomes are. And one of the other interesting factors in that paper, which I was about to mention as well, too, is that it was observed, at least in this narrow case that we studied, the more sensors that you have, the easier it is to deceive you, which was not intuitively obvious. You'd think, gosh, you know, if I have more ways to understand what's around me, I would be more likely to get the right action. But deception works in this particular case, it appears, due to the fact that we can exploit multiple channels of information.
You know, hearing that, I can't help but be reminded of Isaac Asimov. He, of course, had the classic book, I, Robot, which is a series of short stories about robots, and they're very analytical. They're all about robots obeying the three rules of robotics and humans trying to figure out how the robots are behaving. And there's a story in there called Little Lost Robot, and in this, a researcher loses his temper and swears at a particular robot and tells it to get lost, and it does so, And then the chief robo-psychologist, Dr. Susan Calvin, comes in to find it. So I couldn't help but be reminded of that. It's a fairly lighthearted tale.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting because just in the context of the experiment that Arkin and Wagner did, they used interdependence theory and game theory to develop the algorithms that tested the value of deception in a specific situation. And the situation had to satisfy two key conditions to warrant deception.
Okay.
There has to be a conflict between the deceiving robot and the seeker, and the deceiver must benefit from the deception. So what we're talking about here is like an elaborate hide-and-seek game. Or not so elaborate, essentially. To test their algorithms, they ran 20 hide-and-seek experiments with two autonomous robots, and they had colored markers, which they lined up along three potential pathways to locations where the robot could hide. And so the hider robot randomly selected a hiding location from the three location choices and then moved toward that location, knocking down colored markers along the way. So once it reached a point past the markers, the robot changed course and then hid in one of the other two locations. And the presence or the absence of standing markers indicated the hider's location to the seeker robot.
Okay. Well, this is like a very basic form of deception. We see this in movies all the time where the hero is running through an office building trying to escape somebody. So what does he do? He or she runs to this door at the end of the hallway, opens it real wide, lets it shut, but then goes off in another direction.
Right.
The guys, they're chasing him, or gals, come around the corner and see the door slamming. They're like, ah, they went that way, chase them. Or it's like if you're in the forest and you're making your way past these branches, if you started snapping branches along one direction and then backtracked and went somewhere else to hide. And then your pursuers would come through and they'd say, well, look, clearly they went this way because this is where the branches are snapped off.
Right, right. And it seems basic, right? In the sense, the physical sense that we think of. But think about all of that information, all that data that you have to absorb, and then the choices that you have to make on that we take that for granted, right, with our brains. But trying to program that in a robot is particularly interesting and quite a challenge. And so what seems rudimentary now and is rudimentary in terms of robotics, we know will become much more nuanced later on. And so that's why a lot of people are looking at this deception, even if it is on this level, sort of hide and seek level, and saying, wow, okay, you can do that in robots now. What is that going to look like in 5 years? And so, Arkin actually talked a little bit about the attention the experiment received in that regard and how programming a robot to deceive is really similar to thinking like a con man.
A significant amount of press, I guess is the best way to put it. Attention is another way to put it, which I would contend is probably somewhat disproportionate to the results that we obtained. But it is a controversial piece of work, nonetheless. It was the first in-depth study of the phenomena of robot deception and the ability of a robot to deceive other robots or potentially human beings as well. And we looked very closely at interdependence theory, a cognitive science model, as well as game theory, as the basis for understanding two things about robotic deception. The first is, when is it appropriate to deceive? Because you don't want a robot to be deceiving people all the time,
right,
or else it would not have any value. And we were typically looking at, in this early work, what I'll call one-shot deception, trying to deceive someone just once, and that's good enough. Kind of like a con man. The second is how to be able to accomplish that. And I could talk a little bit more in depth about those. But I should say that much of the work that was based on some of Alan's earlier work on trust, because as any good con man knows, a precursor to deception is the establishment of trust.
Yeah.
But we were interested in that particular case of learning how a robot could trust a human being rather than the classic case for man-machine systems. How can a human learn to trust a robot?
Right.
There are many instances such as 9/11, for example, when people act in ways that are improper, to say the least.
Right.
And automation should be able to override them when they are doing that. Machines should know when not to trust a human being. And using the same kind of models and the same kind of situational analysis, but now looking at ways in which we could induce the observer which we'll call the mark mm-hmm. in this particular case, which okay. is the language you would use in this, that we could induce a outcome belief in the mark that an action they would take would be more beneficial to them than would be if they took another action, but it actually ends up being more beneficial to the robot in this particular case, is the strategy that we use to address the how. Imagine a military situation, and the robot has valuable information, or in and of itself, it's a valuable resource, and does not want to be captured or reverse engineered, or whatever the case may be. Now, granted, you could put self-destruction capabilities in it, so it would not be the case, but that destroys the asset that you would want to preserve. And it may have valuable information of its own, in its own right. Strangely, R2-D2 in the original Star Wars comes to mind, you know, get this to Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right.
That wasn't our motivation. What not just playing hide-and-seek in the sense of some other folks have done this with robots, is mm-hmm. robot finds a good place to hide and hopes for the best. But in this case, the robot models the pursuer using a very crude version of what's called theory of mind. It tries to establish what would the pursuer do in these particular sets of circumstances, and leaves as a consequence of that, a false trail. It's kind of like putting mud down or tracks down and saying, I'm over here, but then backtracking and hiding in a different location. So it is the robot's belief that if the pursuer sees that trail, the pursuer will move in that direction. And if that is indeed the case, the robot hides at some other location, the pursuer goes down that trail, and then the robot can escape after that. So that's the notional aspect in that particular case.
So in a way, we're kind of talking about robot original sin here. You know, up until this point, we've just had robots doing what they're programmed to do. And if, say, an industrial robot just, you know, welds a man's face off, it's not doing that with any intent to weld someone's face off. But in this scenario, we're creating a robot that can lie. And I find it really interesting that it's, you know, we're talking about a very simple form of lying, a very simple form of deception that will grow into more complicated forms of behavior. It's kind of like looking at, say, the first time like a child lies,
mm-hmm.
or even just how lies themselves have the tendency to start very small and then if unresolved to grow and grow and grow and to become this greater, more complicated and complex thing.
Yeah, it is. But when you think about lies, you also know that there's another side to it, that lies can be really helpful, right? They can actually, and we do it for many reasons, but sometimes we do it to spare people's feelings, or there might be a dangerous situation and you need to lie about something. I don't know.
Yeah. Paramedics arrive on a scene. The guy asks, hey doc, am I going to make it? The doc's not going to say, maybe, or, you know, the doc's going to say, hang in there. We can
right.
do this.
Right. So, I mean, they're essential to our own existence, and they're certainly essential to warfare. And so that's when you look at something like these, what they're being called, Decepticons, these, deceiving robots, that they could actually be very useful in search and rescue missions.
Right.
And of course, there's the idea that they could be more fully engaged in battle. But of course, the challenge is to be able to give robots the ability to judge a situation and act accordingly and as ethically as possible. So again, that's where these sort of uncomfortable bits of information start to butt up against each other. Because it's like, here, on the one hand, we have this great technology that can do this. On the other hand, you know, we're humans and we know that we are programmed not necessarily to be the most altruistic beings. So how can we create something that's not necessarily in our image, but is better than us?
Hmm.
It's an interesting proposition. So there's a good scenario of that sort of judgment center that we have that we're trying to actually finesse, hopefully, in robots. And the scenario at a robotic level is what Arkin is talking about when he talks about instilling in robots a more sophisticated, nuanced way to assess a situation and act accordingly. This is from a New York Times article. It's called A Soldier Taking Orders from Its Ethical Judgment Center. They talked to Dr. Arkin about this computer model, and it's a robot pilot who flies past a cemetery and spots a tank at the entrance. And this is the target in this scenario. But there's a group of civilians in this computer model, and they're gathered at the cemetery, and the robot pilot considers the data and decides to keep going. But soon it spots another tank out in a field, all alone, and it decides to fire on it. So again, here are these different models that scientists and researchers are trying to put together in order to, you know, assemble this sort of judgment center for robots themselves. And there's obvious limitations to the technology right now as it stands.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
But there's the possibility that machines could one day assess situations with the advantage of not engaging in our something like our own confirmation bias, you know, where we sort of perpetuate information that's faulty information because we want it to fit with our worldview. And then also we get impassioned about things, right? We don't always think clearly, particularly in cases of war.
Right.
Yeah. So we talked to Arkin and we wanted to find out why people might be frightened of this proposition where we might have a technology that could essentially help us one day to make better choices in war, but also, you know, why we might be a little bit freaked out by that.
Well, I mean, the basic prospect is making war easier to wage, like easier to decide to wage war. I mean, that's one of the big arguments against robotic warfare is that it becomes, if there are fewer human lives on our side on the line and fewer chances of there being some sort of a horrible headline grabbing scenario in terms of enemy casualties, then why not declare war, right? Over any little thing, over, you know, energy crisis, you need some oil, just declare war because the robots, you're not going to lose anybody. You're not going to have grieving families voting against you in the upcoming election. And if your robots can, you know, are really good at not, causing a whole bunch of civilian deaths, then, it's more surgical and strategic.
See, and this is what is so interesting, that Arkin has to say about this, particularly when you talk about protocols of war.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he has to say about it.
Well, we need to talk about it is the most important thing. And as I've often said, that the research I have done in that particular space, is one aspect, but the discussion that research engenders is as important as the research itself, at least to me. And as such, I've spent a lot of time talking about it, not only to the media, but also at military bases, at philosophy conferences, at the International Committee of the Red Cross, where they developed the Geneva Conventions just last month, a variety of different locations, ethics groups and the like as well, to answer that very question. So it would be really presumptuous of me to say, this is perfectly safe, don't worry about it, or the sky is falling, like some of my colleagues are doing as well, too. What I do say is that if we are going to allow these robots to make these life or death situations decisions, if we're going to allow these robots to make these life or death decisions on their own to some degree, I mean, they're not just going to go out and start looking at someone and say, should I kill that individual? They will be tasked by a human being in a mission context and then make that particular decision. But if we're going to do that, we need to understand what it is that we're doing, what, if any, bounds are appropriate. And from my perspective, if we're going to do that, they must adhere to the existing laws of war and the rules of engagement, as we as a society already do. And so that's what my work is about. I have often said that while I do believe that we can actually do better than human beings in these situations, that if it ended up that intelligent lethal robots were banned from the battlefield, I'm not averse to that. Although I still do believe that we can actually do better than human beings in making the right decisions regarding lethal application of force under certain circumstances. And it's really important to understand that I am not talking about replacing a soldier with a robot. I'm talking about augmenting soldiers with robots and using them in highly specialized missions such as building clearing operations, counter-sniper operations, things of that particular sort, which is quite different than saying, here's a Terminator, and that's going to replace that particular soldier. Very narrow, well-defined situations where something called bounded morality applies. And that's what makes it tractable. because human morality is extremely complex, involving multiple brain systems and other aspects of that. Machine learning, deliberation, all sorts of things could be brought to bear in applying it in that context. But what's interesting is the lethal application of force is relatively low-hanging fruit for a person dealing with computational morality for a couple of reasons. The primary one is that philosophers have been thinking about it for thousands of years. Under what circumstances is it appropriate to kill someone? And we have, as a civilization, a Western civilization, codified the laws of war through the Hague and Geneva Conventions, and others as well, too, and said, when you kill someone, this is how you do it, and this is what you don't do. And we tell our soldiers, we don't hand them a rifle and say, figure out what the morality is in the battlefield, and say, go and conduct your mission. We train them, and we say, this is what you do, and this is what you don't do. I also want to preface this. I have the utmost respect for our warfighters, our young men and women in the battlefield. It's crucially important that that be understood. But human beings, not all, but many, perform outside the bounds of what is prescribed due to reasons such as frustration, anger, fear, scenario fulfillment, which is what you were talking about earlier, where you might believe something is going to occur and then discard new incoming evidence, a cognitive phenomena. So how we cope with all these different kinds of things leads to, in certain cases, the commission of war crimes. And if you look at the Surgeon General's report, which came out in 2006, if I remember correctly, in studying the data of the self-reported data from the soldiers in Operation Iraqi Freedom, I think that was the one, Iraqi Freedom, the numbers are staggering in terms of what was believed to be unethical behavior in terms of the performance, their inability to report on unethical actions of their colleagues, their inability to distinguish between insurgents and civilians. 20%, almost 20%, considered you're either an enemy or you're not. There was nothing in between in that case. So they didn't understand the notion of noncombatants. 19% considered noncombatants insurgents under the circumstances. And the data went on and on, which was, that was mind-blowing, if you want to talk about that, at least to me, in terms of the potential room for improvement.
So he makes a really interesting case in developing the technology, but stepping back from it and saying that we're at a point in history where we can actually look at it and say, you know, ethically, should we do this? Should we consider the following things? And I think that that's interesting because in science, we've always sort of rushed forward, right? Historically, because we've been really excited about what we could make, what we could create, what we could do. And then after the fact, stepped back and went, whoa, you know, maybe this was misused or this was a misused application.
Right.
So I think it's really heartening that he is someone who's at the forefront of the ethics and is really trying to tell people, like, you know, let's think about this. Let's be smart about this.
Yeah, and especially in informing the people that are in the position to make decisions who are many times a pretty big distance away from actual understanding of what's possible and what's not possible in computing and robotics. So you don't want somebody that's, you know, some politician that's far removed from it saying, yeah, robot soldiers, that sounds great. We're not going to have so many soldiers die. Cool, let's do that. But they need to understand on some level that what's at stake ethically and what the ethical arguments are.
Yeah, and what Arkin also had pointed out to when he and I talked is that the lawmakers most of the time aren't even really aware of what's available technologically out there. So a lot of this is trying to educate the public and policymakers and make them aware so that they can understand what's at stake. So it's very interesting. And I have to say that, you've always taken the tack of being more positive when it comes to singularity. And I've always kind of been, they're going to take us over. You know, I have my days. But in talking to Arkin, I thought that he had a really interesting perspective on that as well. And something that he talks about, robots in the context of them filling an ecological niche for us.
Okay.
So let's listen to this bit of, information about the technological singularity.
And the lay definition is referred to as the point where machine intelligence exceeds human intelligence. Are we there already? Watson won in Jeopardy, right? So, you know, it's a question of how you define these things as well. At some levels, we're already there. So is it when we have data? You know, I don't even understand exactly what the singularity is. I do believe the machines will get smarter and smarter. I actually don't believe they necessarily should be compared to human intelligence. I think robotic intelligence, just as dog intelligence and ape intelligence and ant intelligence, is different than human intelligence. I believe that robotic intelligence will be something, if allowed to be, instead of forced into the human paradigm, something different than human intelligence. They fill what are referred to as ecological niches, places within the world where they can survive and prosper and grow. And why on earth would we want, or in space for that matter, why anywhere would we want to create something that is completely and utterly competing with us in the same ecological niche? That can lead to extinction in that case, where you'll be displaced. I don't think that's a wise idea, personally. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do robotics. We just need to do the right kind, whatever that happens to be. We can't all go off into our corner, raise our flag, and say, yes, yes, no, no. We have to talk with each other and understand. And by each other, I don't mean a bunch of roboticists. I mean policymakers. I mean roboticists. I mean the military. I mean civilian populations. I mean theologians. I mean stakeholders is what they're referred to. All the stakeholders have to get together and come to grips with what it is that we're creating and start to think, first of all, what needs to be regulated. And once that is determined, how much regulation is appropriate under these sets of circumstances. And this is an ongoing process. It's not going to be a set of commandments that says, this is it, this is the way it will always be. It's a living document and the like. And some of my colleagues are doing that in other spaces as well. But I've been very pleased with the traction that robot ethics is beginning to get. It felt a little bit at times in the early days of a voice crying in the wilderness, but more and more people are getting involved. There's a new special issue on robot ethics coming out in the IEEE magazine on robotics and automation. So I see many of my colleagues starting to say things about it and to take it seriously and to speak their minds as to what they think is right, as opposed to what I, as a scientist myself, when I was a bench chemist or whether I was a roboticist, were driven purely by curiosity-driven research, where we just want to understand something, whether it's how to make a better molecule or whether it's how to understand the principles of intelligence and imbue them in the machine. Concurrently, we need to understand how or what the consequences of that are, of that is. Once we do that, I think we can truly call ourselves responsible scientists.
Okay, so how do you feel about that? Does it make you feel a little easier about the robots gaining power, or?
Yeah, actually, it did. It made me understand it more in the context of, okay, well, you know, it would be really, and we've said this before, really stupid for us to create something that destroys us. Right. I mean, it's not. It's not beyond.
It's certainly not beyond the pale. No.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we could do it, but knowing that the discussion is going on and hearing Arkin talk about robots really enhancing our intelligence or even making us rethink our intelligence is, for me, sort of a paradigm shift in that, humans don't become the other, but the other in the sense that, you know, this is perhaps some sort of technology that can continue to help us evolve, not necessarily be trampled upon and then become human servants to our robot overlords.
Yeah, I guess people fear it in a way. It reminds me when I was a kid and used to live in Tennessee, and there was this trailer we would drive by, and it started as a single trailer, and then they built onto the side of it like a big room here and a big room there, and then there was more and more until you couldn't see the trailer anymore, And then one day they pulled the trailer out of the middle of it and I guess filled it in, and just made it a house. So I guess one could fear, what if we are the trailer in this scenario where we continually augment human life and the human experience and in our an entire culture here on Earth and beyond, and then we reach the point to where the trailer is no longer necessary part of the equation.
Huh.
But I'm not saying I share that idea, but
I like that idea. I thought you were going to start off with some sort of Boo Radley story there.
Boo Radley.
As perhaps embodying the robot, and we just didn't know the robots well enough yet.
No. Well, yeah. Now, growing up, we did have the town robot, but it was largely, its main duties were just cleaning the streets and apprehending stray criminals, you know?
I see.
But,
I see.
I mean, that's everybody's small town experience.
Of course, yeah. Jeez. Paris, Texas, best robots ever. Well, this was really interesting to talk to Dr. Arkin, and we actually have a lot of other information that he shared with us so very generously. He talks about robot ethics in the context of the class that he teaches, which is Robots in Society, and he talks with his students about...
His human students
about actual human relations with robots, which we've talked about before, sex with bots. That's not his entire class. There are many other ethical situations that he talks about. But we will definitely do some follow-up with Dr. Arkin and some other topics. It was really fascinating to learn more about what he's doing here in Atlanta at Georgia Tech. And we'd like to thank him for taking the time to speak with us. And just so you know, a little bit more about Dr. Arkin, he served as a founding co-chair of the IEEE Robotics and Automation Society Technical Committee on Robotic Ethics from 2004 and 2009, and is the co-chair of the Society's Human Rights and Ethics Committee, as well as the IEEE RAS liaison to the Society on Social Implications of Technology.
Well, hey, we have some listener mail, so I think I'm going to jump into that. All the bits that I have here are actually a follow-up to our Pope on a Cosmic Rope episode.
Yes.
Which we received a number of comments about and seemed to get a lot of people thinking. And oddly enough, I don't think we received any hate mail over that. I mean, not that we were fishing for it, but...
No. I mean, yeah, after all, we did sort of hint that they might be wearing skinny jeans under their vestments. I thought for sure someone would strike out at us against that, but, you know.
But, I think, you know, the obviously people of faith have a sense of humor, and we actually heard from a few of them here, as well as one person who just has a reading recommendation. Our listener Albert writes in and says, "Enjoyed your podcast. I was reminded of a book by Maria Doria Russell, The Sparrow, which fits into your theme. Space exploration funded by the Vatican encounters aliens. That's a bare-bones description. It's dark and deals with complex theological issues." Well, that sounds good.
All right.
I may have to add that to the list of things to read. The next one comes from Matthew, who is a scientist from New Jersey. And Matthew writes, "Dear Robert and Julie, great fan of the podcast. But when I heard your Pope on a Cosmic Rope, I cringed a little at on your idea of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is not a democracy, so what's popular or in style doesn't change the doctrines. I can assure you, no great principles get changed without careful religious deliberations, and in fact, extraterrestrial life has never been contradictory to Catholicism. Thanks for reading my input, and keep up the good work."
All right.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Robert, you haven't said a thing about the hair shirt that I'm wearing.
Oh, well, go ahead and talk about the hair shirt. Okay. I had been just being polite about it. But, you know.
Well, I know, and I thank you for that. You're very sensitive, but it is probably the second or third time I've been wearing this hair shirt. But now I'm wearing it because I believe that it was me who called Clostridium difficile a virus, when it is indeed bacteria.
Oh, did the bacteria itself write in?
It did.
Oh, it's, that's embarrassing.
I know, that's awful when the actual bacteria writes in and says, "I am no virus, and I would like for you to go ahead and make the world know that that's the case." And so, I apologize, T. Diff.
All right, well, hopefully that will appease any both virus and bacteria that are listening to us.
Yeah.
One more bit of listener mail, this one from listener... Ophelia from Devon, United Kingdom, where I think I've actually been. I think it's on one of the canals or something. Anyway, if it's the town I'm thinking about, it's really, really cool little town. Anyway, she writes in and says, I really enjoyed your podcast on the relationship between science and the Catholic Church. I've wondered since I was a little kid what Catholics would do if aliens were discovered, so I really got a kick out of the topic. I'm a devout Catholic studying archaeology, so the conflict between the Church and science is an important one to me, especially concerning evolution. It's really encouraging to hear about people like Guy Consolmagno, who are passionate about both religion and science, and what he said about fundamentalists was excellent. In fact, while they have certainly been that way in the past, the modern Catholic Church is not nearly so harsh about its views as a lot of people seem to think. They have been okay with and even encouraged adult stem cell research for many years, and Pope John Paul II published an encyclical stating that much of evolutionary theory is not in direct contradiction with the views of the Church. So I'm really glad to hear that the Church has been making efforts to make their views better known. I hope they continue with this because it would make me feel much more confident in being a Catholic archaeologist. Keep going with the great podcasts. I always enjoy them when I'm taking a break from work or going to bed, and I like how I get to learn something new even when I'm relaxing. Cheers.
Cheers to you, Ophelia. Thank you for writing.
Yes, and if anybody else out there has stuff you want to share with us, I encourage you to visit Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those. Find us on Facebook, push like, join us, follow us, and see what we're up to. And on Twitter, I encourage you to share cool links that you may find or cool facts that, worm their way into your life by just throwing it up on Twitter with the hashtag Blew My Mind, one word, the hashtag hash Blew My Mind. And then we'll see it and we'll get to share it. And, because I think that's a hashtag we really can reclaim as listeners.
That's right. We can find some very cool, mind-blowing stuff to share with each other.
Yeah.
And if you would like to share some other mind-blowing stuff with us, you can always do so via email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.